Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is HTTP Protocol Breakdown Request Headers. Today's presenter is Robert L. Boretti, Jr. Robert has been with the IBM Corporation for 12 years and supporting the IBM HTTP Server and WebSphere HTTP plugin for 7 years and currently an advisory software engineer with L2 WebSphere Application Server Support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Robert.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's presentation. As Joseph had indicated, my name is Robert L. Boretti, Jr., and I've been working with the HTTP web server, HTTP plugin, for many, many years now, and have also been very heavily involved in the HTTP protocol. As a result, I decided that it would be a great idea to share some of the things that I've learned with external customers, and that is the reason for today's presentation. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 2 to get started. Okay, the main focus of today's presentation will be to help you to understand the common HTTP request headers, which are most often seen in WebSphere environments when requesting dynamic and static HTTP content. For additional information, you may consider reviewing RFC 2616 Section 14, which contains detailed descriptions of all HTTP headers, including the request headers discussed in today's presentation. In addition, I will focus on providing you an overview of the common request methods GET, HEAD, and POST. Also, I will provide you a clear description of the most common HTTP request header fields. Next, I will provide you examples of actual recorded HTTP request headers to help you put things into context when it comes to observing these headers in your own WebSphere application server environments. Lastly, I will identify and provide examples of specific log outputs where these headers are recorded so you can find them in your own WebSphere application server environments later on. These logs include TCP/IP packet traces, web server access logs, and WebSphere HTTP plugin log file called http://plugin.log. Along with that, we'll also talk briefly about the WebSphere application servers trace.log. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 3 to get started. First, let's discuss how to find RFC 2616, which contains detailed descriptions of all HTTP request headers observed in today's internet marketplace. The quickest and easiest way to find Section 14 of the RFC 2616 is by using Google or another search engine of your choosing and then searching on keywords HTTP request headers. By simply using that keyword, you'll be able to find the link to this RFC, and all of these headers are recorded. Also, for your convenience, I have included a direct link to Section 14 of the RFC 2616 to save you some time. Please note that I'm not here to reinvent the wheel, and therefore most of the verbiage observed throughout this presentation is derived directly from the RFC and only modified slightly when I need to make a point as it specifically relates to WebSphere application server environments. So with that said, let's proceed to slide number 4, where I will first discuss common HTTP request methods. There are 3 common request methods we see in today's WebSphere application server environments. The first one is the GET method, which means retrieve whatever information is identified by the request URI. In simple terms, when a client issues a GET, it is asking the server for something. For example, a GET for index.html is the client telling the server to get that HTML page and return it to the client. Another example in human terms would be like asking someone to get you a cup of coffee, and then they go get you that cup of coffee and give it to you. Very simple. The next method is the HEAD method, which is identical to GET, except that the server must not return a message body in the response. In simple terms, when a client issues a HEAD request, it typically is looking to receive the response status code only and not the actual body content. An example in human terms would would be like asking someone to run across the street to the store and see if they have milk and asking them only to let you know if they have milk without actually having them bring you back any, since you were only interested in knowing if they had any. No, many load balancers are configured to issue head requests to check the health of a server. They simply want to know if the server is available to handle the request and not actually return the content to the load balancer. Okay, and that's why load balancers, usually we use the head request instead of a get request to check the health of a back-end server. The last common method we see in Web3 application server environments is the POST method, which is used to request the origin server to accept the entity enclosed in the request as a new subordinate of the resource identified by the request URI in the request line. In simple terms, when a client issues a POST request, it is sending data to the server. Examples, uploading a file, submitting user information, credit card data, etc. Another example, in human terms, would be like asking someone for a cup of coffee, and then once you get it back, adding sugar to the coffee, and then giving it back to the person who gave you the cup of coffee to begin with. In this case, adding the sugar to the coffee and giving it back to the person who got it for you is the actual POST. Now, with that, we have discussed the three common methods used in today's WebSphere environments. So let's proceed to slide number 5 to get started with reviewing common HTTP request headers. There are many request headers to discuss in today's presentation. The first one is the accept request header, which can be used to specify certain media types which are acceptable for the response. In simple terms, this is how the client notifies the server what media type format the client is willing to accept the response in. Next, the accept encoding header is similar to the accept, but restricts the content codings that are acceptable in the response, typically used to inform the server that the client will accept a response that is compressed. The last request header on this slide is the accept language request header, which is similar to accept, but restricts the set of natural languages that are preferred as a response to the request. Note, language tags are defined in section 3.10 of RFC 2616. Basically, the above example shows the client is willing to accept the response in the U.S. English language. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 6 to review more HTTP request headers. Another HTTP request header is the authorization header. Any client that wishes to authenticate itself with a server, usually, but not necessarily, after receiving a 401 response, does so by including an authorization request header field with the request. The authorization field value consists of credentials containing the authentication information of the client for the realm of the resource being requested. In simple terms, the authorization header typically includes the user ID and password needed to authenticate with the server. Note, authorization headers are not used for form-based logins. Instead, the user information is included in the form itself, using the POST method to submit the form with the user credentials. Next, the connection header allows the sender to specify options that are desired for that particular connection. If a client sends a connection close header with a request, it is telling the server to close the connection after it sends the response instead of keeping the connection open. Last on this slide is the cache control header, which is used to specify directives that must be obeyed by all caching mechanisms along the request and response chain. The directives specify behavior intended to prevent caches from adversely interfering with the request or the response, typically seen for POST requests, so that any caching mechanism along the way do not cache the submitted POST data, but instead simply pass it along to the intended server. Okay, so with that said, let's proceed to slide number 7. On this slide, the content length header indicates the size of the entity body in decimal number of octets, typically seen for post requests to notify the server of how much content the client is sending. As the above example shows, the client in this case is telling the server to expect 3,495 bytes of data in the entity body of the request. Next, the content type header indicates the media type of the entity body sent to the recipient. Again, typically seen for post requests to notify the server what type of content the client is sending. As the above example shows, the client in this case is telling the server the entity body is being sent in the text HTML format. Lastly, on the slide is a very common HTTP request header called the host request header. This header is included with every client request and specifies the internet host and port number of the resource being requested as obtained from the original URI given by the user or referring resource. It is important to note that when issuing a non-SSL request, if the port is not seen in the host header, then this implies port 80 by default. The same is true for SSL requests. If the port is not seen in the host header, then this implies that port 443 is used by default. Okay? So with that, let's continue the topic of common request headers by proceeding to slide number 8. The if modified since request header is used with a method to make it conditional. If the requested variant has not been modified since the time specified in this field, an entity will not be returned from the server. Instead, a 304 not modified response will be returned without any message body. Next, the refer request header allows the client to specify, for the server's benefit, the address URI of the resource from which the request URI was obtained. For example, a client may submit a request for an index.html page, but in addition, part of the page includes additional requests for images, which are associated with the index.html page. As a result, the index.html page is now the referrer of the image request. Therefore, the request header referencing the index.html page will appear as one of the headers in the additional request for the image request. Another request header is the user agent header, which contains information about the client originating the request. For example, if the client which made the request is a Mozilla 4.0 browser, the user agent request header will appear in each client request showing this to be the case. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 9 at this time. So on slide number 9, the expect header is used to indicate that particular server behaviors are required by the client. The HTTP plugin, for example, will always send an expect 100 continue header when issuing a post request to a back-end WebSphere application server. Note, the purpose of the 100 continue status, which is the response, is to allow a client that is sending a request message with a request body to determine if the origin server is willing to accept the request based on the request headers only before the client sends the request body. Lastly on this slide is the cookie header. This is a header is included by the client with an HTTP request sent to the server when the client has a stored cookie that needs to be included with the request. For example, if a client has a JSession ID cookie stored in the browser, when it issues a request for WebSphere application server content, it should automatically include a cookie header with the request containing the JSession ID. In this case, the JSession ID cookie contains the session information along with the clone ID of the server where the client session was initially established. Note, clients should only include cookie headers when making HTTP requests and include all applicable cookies in the header, separating each cookie with a semicolon. Very important to separate cookies with a semicolon. There should only be one cookie header. Okay, so this concludes our review of common HTTP request headers per RFC 2616. However, there are still additional request headers specific to the WebSphere HTTP plugin, which we will discuss next. So with that, let's proceed to slide number 10 to get started with those. The WebSphere HTTP plugin, which runs in the web server, also acts as a client when making HTTP requests to a back-end WebSphere application server. When the HTTP plugin makes an HTTP request, it typically will include the HTTP request headers it received from the originating client which issued the request. However, in addition to including these headers, there are special headers which the plugin also includes when making HTTP requests to back-end WebSphere application servers. These are called plugin private headers and are only allowed to be created and used by the HTTP plugin when building and submitting HTTP requests. So let's proceed by briefly discussing these headers. First, the surrogate capability header is used when the ESI processor is enabled in the plugin CFG.xml and a cache miss occurs. The surrogate capabilities header is added to the request and the request is forwarded to the WebSphere application server. WebSphere will provide the response and let the plugin know if the content can be cached by the ESI processor. Next, the $WSAT header is added when authentication is enabled and the plugin needs to inform the backend what authentication type was used. Lastly on this slide is the $WSCC header, and that is used to supply the client certificate used for this request. Now note, this is the client certificate which was passed by the client browser during the SSL handshake between the client and the web server when the client certificate authentication is enabled on that web server. This client certificate also gets passed to WebSphere by the plugin via this $WSCC header. Note, if the value is not base64 encoded for us by the web server, then the plugin will base64 encode it before sending it across to the application server. Okay, very important to understand that. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 11 to review more of the private headers created by the WebSphere plugin. Okay, so on this screen here, or slide number 11, if SSL is enabled on the web server and the handshake is successful, the plugin will get to process the request and send the request to WebSphere. Very simple. But the plugin will add the $WSCS header to the request to notify the backend WebSphere server of the cipher suite that the WebSphere server negotiated with the client. Note, this is not necessarily the cipher suite that the plugin will use to send the request across to the application server. So very important to understand that distinction. Next, the $WSIS header will be set to either true or false, depending on whether or not the request is secure or not, basically came in over SSL or non-SSL. Again, this value is based on whether SSL is enabled between the client and the web server. Okay, so if SSL is not enabled between the client and the web server, even if you have SSL enabled between the plugin and the back end, this header would be set to HTTP and not HTTPS. Okay, so moving forward, there are still more private HTTP request headers, which we will discuss on the next couple of slides. So let's proceed to slide number 12 at this time. The $WSPR header is used to indicate the HTTP protocol level being used for this request. Note, the plugin currently has support for up to HTTP 1.1 requests. So it could be 1.0 requests or 1.1 requests. The plugin, note, the plugin itself, current plugin for 6.0, 6.1, 7.0 are all HTTP 1.1, but they will still accept a client request that came in as HTTP 1.0. Next, the $WSRA header is used to indicate the remote IP address of the machine the client is running on. Now, it is important to note here that if a load balancer is used in front of the web server that masks the client IP address from the web server, then the IP address which appears in this header will most likely be that of the load balancer and not of the actual client machine where the request originated from. Lastly on this slide is the $WSRH header, which is used to indicate the remote host name of the machine the client is running on. If the host name can't be resolved, then this header should be set to the IP address. Again, if a load balancer is used in front of the web server that is masking, so if you have a load balancer in front of your web server and it's masking the client IP address from the web server, then the IP address which appears in this header will most likely be that of the load balancer and not the actual client machine where the request originated from. So let's proceed to slide number 13, which contains the final set of private plugin headers. Okay, so on this screen, if client authentication is enabled on the web server, the user ID that was used to authenticate with the web server will be added by the plugin in the $WSRU header and supplied to WebSphere. Next, the $WSSN header indicates the server name used for this request. Note, this should be the value that was specified in the host header of the incoming request issued by the originating client. Also, the $WSSP header indicates the server port that the request was received on. This will be the port value that is used in route determination. Note, this is the port the web server received the request on. Lastly, the $WSSI header indicates the SSL session ID being used for this request. If the value is not base64 encoded for us by the web server, then the HTTP plugin will base64 encode it before sending it across to the application server. So this concludes our discussion on private headers used by the plugin. So let's proceed to slide number 14, where I will begin to discuss where HTTP request headers are logged so that you can understand them better. So now that we talked about headers and their meanings, okay, and we gave a few examples, now that we've gone over that, let's talk about where this information is logged so that you can also review this information in your own environment. There are several important logs where HTTP request headers can be logged. The first such log is a packet trace, which can be enabled to capture TCP/IP packets on a network that contain the HTTP request and response headers sent back and forth between the client and the server. A common packet trace tool available on the internet is Wireshark and can be downloaded from www.wireshark.org. Unfortunately, due to customer confidentiality, I am unable to provide packet trace output in this presentation. However, I do want to note that if you do use a Wireshark to collect a packet trace, if it's over non-SSL, okay, if you select any one of your packets in that trace and right-click and click on Follow TCP Stream, that will actually bring up a separate dialog box which will show you all of the request headers along with the response headers. Okay? If the packet trace is over SSL, then obviously the data is encrypted and you can't see it by default. However, the latest Wireshark does allow you, if you have your certificates available, et cetera, you can actually use Wireshark and point to your certificates to unencrypt those packets. And again, once that happens, then you can do the same thing by right-clicking on any packet, doing Follow TCP Stream, and that'll actually show you all of the request headers and response headers. Okay? Next, an incoming HTTP request header field details can be logged in the IBM HTTP service access log. So any incoming HTTP request header field can be logged in the access log, okay, using a custom log format. Okay, and the actual format you would want to use is percent bracket header name percent bracket I, okay? And I stands for incoming header, okay? So you would actually just, if you wanted to log your, example would be if you wanted to log your host header, then you could set that to host. And in this example above, we're talking about the accept header, okay? So if you wanted to log the details of the accept header, then simply you would add your log format as percent bracket accept bracket I. And that will actually log the details of the accept header that was received for the request in question. All right, so let's proceed to slide number 15. Okay, so in addition to the web service access log, if you set log level in the plugin CFG.xml to trace, then HTTP request headers which are passed by the HTTP plugin to WebSphere are logged in this http_plugin.log. As the above example shows, we can see the plugin is issuing a GET request and including the accept, the refer, the accept language, the accept encoding, and the user agent headers, along with some of the plugin private headers we discussed earlier. Okay? So if you edit your plugin CFG.xml and change log level to trace, then you'll be able to see the headers that are issued with the request to WebSphere. Okay, so last but not least, let's proceed to slide number 16, which shows an example of a WebSphere application service trace.log where HTTP request headers can also be recorded. Okay, so in the previous slide, we discussed HTTP request headers sent by the WebSphere HTTP plugin, okay, and that those are logged in the plugin log. But in addition, if tracing is enabled on the WebSphere application server, these same generated request headers can be logged on the WebSphere side in the trace.log as the above example shows. Okay? It's very simple, but if you enable tracing on the plugin side, you can see the request headers there. If you enable tracing on the application server side in trace.log, you can also see the headers there. Okay, so I would like to wrap up today's presentation by instructing you to proceed to slide number 17. Okay, so this is basically the final slide of the presentation. If you want to obtain more information on HTTP request headers as well as HTTP 1.1, you can visit the above URL there in this slide. This does conclude today's presentation, and I hope you found it useful as well as informative, and I thank you for your time and for choosing IBM, and I'd like to turn the presentation back over to Joseph at this time.
At this point, Sarah, we would like to open the line for questions.
We'll hear from David Green.
You gave a number of common plugin request headers, which are obviously request headers that IBM came up with for use in the plugin to talk to WebSphere. Can you give some examples of why these plugins were necessary? I'm sorry, these special request headers were necessary and how they're used?
Well, as far as all of the headers that are available, I don't know how they're all used. There are reasons that I am aware of for some of them. You know, for example, if you have you can actually code an application, let's say for client certificate authentication, where you only want to allow access to data based on a specific client certificate that was passed by a client browser. So in order for the backend application server to even know what client certificate was used from the handshake between the client and the web server, that certificate information must be passed somehow to WebSphere so WebSphere can look at it. And the only way that can happen is via the $WS CC header. So that would be one example. But the reasons for a lot of them are because applications may want to specifically find out information about the front-end client request that normally wouldn't be provided. Another example would be if you had, let's say, authentication enabled on the web server, like you had your web server set up to communicate to an LDAP server, right? So the user comes in and they authenticate with the LDAP server, you know, pass a user ID and password, okay? Well, the backend application server has no recollection of and no idea what user ID was used to be authenticated on the front-end web server. So by having the $WSRU header field, the plugin can actually put that user ID information in that field and pass it along to the back-end application server. And if the application is coded to look for that information, then now the application also knows what user ID was used to authenticate the client on the front-end web server. So that's just an example of some.
Thank you. We'll move to Herman Hubler.
Hello. First of all, thanks for the presentation and the information provided. This authorization header, what I'm missing here is any information regarding the realm or the host name for which this authorization header is related to. When a server sends a 401 response code to request authorization, the user enters user ID and password. I don't think that this information is sent with every request, but only with requests related to a specific realm or host name.
Well, it would actually be sent based on the URI that's being protected, not necessarily the host name. I mean, it would be specific to the URI that's being requested, because if you're requesting a specific URI, which is everything after the host name, the web server and or the application server could be protecting that particular resource.
Right, but that's based on the realm name, right?
On the realm name?
Yes.
Well, the realm can be anything that you specify. Yes, you can authenticate based on realm, yes.
Yes, but the browser in the authorization header, there's no information about the realm.
In the authorization header?
Yeah.
Well, you may be thinking about the WW authenticate response header.
Okay.
That actually indicates the realm.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
And it appears we have no further questions at this time.
At this time, we will conclude the presentation.